turn to Acts 14, and you know, Acts 13 is the first missionary journey where they go out of Antioch, and Paul and Barnabas, it says they're sent forth by the Holy Ghost. And this morning we spent a lot of time talking about the opposition that they had in verse 6 and verse 8. It's ironic that it's similar opposition to what we have in Zambia, because I'll be honest with you, when I went to Zambia, I thought, you know, the sky's the limit. There is nothing that's going to keep us from having, you know, 100 people saved a day. You know, there's, and that's what I sincerely believed. I really did. People would ask me, you know, what do you think you see as a hindrance over there? I said, I don't see anything as a hindrance. Well, I didn't know anything. I was 27 years old or maybe younger. And I really thought that the phrase you always hear, these people are hungry for the gospel. That's what I believed about Africans. I did. I thought it meant because you would take tracts and pass them out, and everyone wanted one. And you know, you can literally, I'm not joking, you can drive down the road, and if you have tracts, you can pitch them out the window. And you can see people, you know, running over and picking them up. But it doesn't mean they're hungry for the gospel, because if you throw keychains out the window or ink pens or toothbrushes, they're also going to have the mob effect. So does it mean they're hungry for keychains? Of course not. I mean, that, and so, you know, a lot of these things, they do deceive you. And I was quite deceived about the way things are. And, you know, after seeing our big church there go from 260 on average to about 100 on average, I began to ask the question, are these people hungry for the Bible? You know, and after seeing, you know, just for example, I'd try to talk to them about marriage, and I'd explain to them what a biblical marriage was. And I want to choose my words carefully here, because to an African, if you marry a woman that cannot produce children, and of course the African always sees it as the woman, he never figures out it's him. Even if he's had three wives and has had no children, he still sees it as all of these women can't have children. You know, I've often asked them, you know, do you ever think? And they say, no, it's not me. I am a real man. It is not me. You know, and if they marry a woman who can't have children, then, you know, they believe it's like a curse you can't get off of yourself even after you die. Which, what does that mean? What does it mean if you're cursed after you die? I mean, that's, you know, for them, you know, that these things are very weird and bizarre and deep, and I don't understand them. And of course, there's no final authority for the things they believe. I'll ask six Africans, explain this tradition you have. And all six of them have a different opinion of it. And I'll say, you know what your problem is? There are no rules for what you believe. And I pull out, like, for example, you know, they all believe everything about spirits and demons and everything. And I'll say, now here's a maniac of Gadara in the Bible, in the book of Mark. And, you know, here are some symptoms of a person who has an unclean spirit. The person you're telling me about has none of them. What do you make of that? You don't understand demon-possessed people. Well, I'm trying to go by the Bible here, okay? And every demon-possessed person, you know, so-called, that I've seen in Zambia, number one, they're always female. No offense, but it's true. I've never seen a man put on the show that they call the demon-possessed show. For example, we had a young lady, I guess she was about 16 or so. She went to the village. She was told in the village that her grandfather put a curse on her. So she comes back to town, and every church service, well, about every other one during the church service, she would start barking like a dog. She'd fall down on the ground between the benches, boom, boom, and start going, yip, 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 like this. And so the ladies asked me, what should we do? And I said, it's very simple. I want you to pick her up, you know, and take her out underneath the nice shelter in the shade and leave her there till she quits. And I said, aren't you going to pray to cast the spirit out of her? And I said, well, you know, I said, the way I understand the Bible, I don't have the ability to do that. Because, you know, to me, that's an apostolic sign, and I'm not an apostle, and I don't believe I have the signs to cast the spirit out of her. And number three, I don't believe it's an unclean spirit. And that's where the wheels come off. And why don't you believe it's an unclean spirit? I said, I just don't, I've not quite seen the dog barking unclean spirit in the Bible. And they say, okay, what if the person speaks in an African dialect they don't know? I said, all right, chapter and verse. Where's the unclean spirit that does that? Because I'm going to tell you something. Every African knows four dialects. And they all say, yeah, but I know he doesn't know that dialect. And I'm like, you do not know that. You don't know that. They may very well know that dialect, and you don't know. Because I'm telling you, I am a foreigner who has learned one dialect, and Brother Flick comes over from Malawi and speaks Chichewa, and I can understand about a third of what he says. And I'm not an African. So don't tell me Africans can't figure those other languages out, because it's just like you understanding a Southerner or a person from New York or a person from Arizona. It's just like that. It's those dialects are that close. So so this dog barking girl, Brother Donovan happened to be there when she did it one day. And I said, let's go visit her and let's decide what we're going to say to her. And he said, tell her if she doesn't stop, she can never come back to church. And I thought, it's genius. So I told her, the pastor says, if she does not stop, she cannot come to church. And they said, oh. And I said, it's true. And you know what she did? She never did it again. We're going on 2 years now, or two and a half. And one African came to me and said, ah, Brother Mike, you were right. That wasn't the unclean spirit. She was just doing that. And I said, I know I'm right, because I showed you in the Bible that people don't do that. She saw that on TBN, I'm telling you. Because on TBN, that's what they do. You know, that's what they think is an unclean spirit. So anyway, the bottom line is you're dealing with people who are very much into spiritism. And when you come to Acts 13, verse 6, I am going to read a Bible verse here in case you're wondering. Verse 6 says, and when they had gone through the island of Paphos, they found a certain sorcerer. And that's the word they use for him in Zambia, a sorcerer, a false prophet, a Jew whose name was Bar-Jesus. Then again in verse 8, but Elymas the sorcerer, for so is his name by interpretation, withstood them, seeking to turn away the deputy from the faith. And the man in African culture who has all the power over everybody is that guy right there. They believe the sorcerer, he is the final authority. Of course, you know, they all disagree amongst themselves, and all they're in it for is a few kwacha. You know, 20,000 kwacha is the finder's fee. You know, if Brother Felipe gets sick, his family's supposed to pay the 20,000 kwacha, go to the witch doctor, bring maybe his necktie, you know? Bring his necktie to the witch doctor, say, this is Pastor Felipe's necktie, he's sick, we need to know why. And you know what the witch doctor never does? He never says, well, Wally, I don't know why he's sick. And he never says, I don't know who did it to him. But the question in all these animistic African things, the question is who? Who do I place the blame on? And once they find who to place the blame on, that's when all the nastiness starts, because then, you know, they buy something from the witch doctor to counteract that guy, and it's this constant fight. And I've tried to tell my people, listen, in America people die. And Brother Moshkola, the guy at the last there, Samuel, he stood up one day, he said, I want to thank Brother Mike for coming from America, because now I know people do die there. Because, you know, I told him my dad's deathly ill, you know, they said, yeah, you know, I never thought about it, but in America people die. You know, one African asked me, he said, when you go to America, why don't you take the bus? I said, it's real expensive. It's just too far on the bus. Yeah, you know. Yeah. I said, brother, have you not heard about that ocean in between? No. You know, and I get tickled, you know, American preacher comes over, I invite a guy to preach, you know, and he draws on the board Iwo Jima. You know, this African doesn't know the continent's surrounded by water and has an ocean on one side. You can't drive to America. And my preacher friend, you know, he gets up, he draws a map of Iwo Jima and preaches on World War II, and African's like, yeah. It's just like, oh, man. I saw one guy preaching. He was talking about a man in a body cast. He was preaching through an interpreter. I went up to the interpreter and I said, hey, so how'd you handle that body cast thing, brother? He said, I don't know what it is. I said, I know. I know. But I mean, you know, after a while, you know, for example, one guy was preaching about the lady standing at her kitchen sink. Well, there's not an African lady in Africa that's got a kitchen sink. You know, they go outside with a little bowl and they all, you know, I don't know how they do it, but, you know, their body's made to where they can just bend over for 2 hours washing dishes, you know, and they just wash dishes in that little bucket outside. But now I'm running all over the place. But back to, do you guys know what animism is? Have you ever studied animism, except for Brother Hoffman? Of course, he knows. You know what animism is? It means there's a spirit in the tie. And there's a spirit in the pulpit, and there's a spirit in the piano bench, and there's a spirit in the projector, and there's just spirit in everything. And one thing I constantly have to talk to him about is you don't need to worry about what spirit's in the tie. You got to the market, you know. And the first day I ever preached on that, Samuel came to me and he said, "Has any African ever told you that that's a daily conversation? Every day people are getting their clothes from the market, and they're asking people." What do you think? Do you think I need to take this, you know, piece of clothes down to the witch doctor and purchase a, you know, a reverse thing for the spirit in it? You know, because they're always worried about luck. The Bimba Bible in Psalm 1 says, lucky is the man, instead of blessed is the man. You know? And so one day, you know, I have four or five of my closest guys around me, and I said, listen, we need to talk about this luck thing, how a Christian is not lucky, he's blessed, you know? And we just happened to be driving along. We're driving along, and there's a guy holding up a rabbit, a roadkill rabbit by the side of the road, and he's holding up the rabbit, yeah, yeah, and he's dancing his African dance, yeah, you know? And so the guys in the truck say, yeah, he is lucky. And I said, now, wait a minute. Is he lucky, or has God blessed him if he's a Christian, or what? And so we had this long discussion, maybe 15 minutes, and they all look at each other, and they look back at me, and they said, Brother Mike, it's the same thing. I said, okay. All right, he's lucky. All right, whatever. You know, because, I mean, they can't understand that, because to them, everything is luck. I was telling the other church this morning, the marketeer, you know, the guy's got his little market stand. You know, it's 80% unemployment, so they all try to come up with some wares, and you know, they'll like buy a whole bale of secondhand clothing. They'll set up a little market stand, and they'll take a piece of money, and they'll go down to the witch doctor and get a little charm, and they'll put that charm with the money and hide it, and they really have faith that if they buy that charm and put it with a piece of money, it will magically, mystically make their business good. So, of course, I preach about that, you know. You know, I preach about all these little things like, I don't know if you've ever seen or heard, but they'll wear, it looks like Goodyear tire rubber around their wrist. And what it is, it's just a piece of rubber that has been blessed by the witch doctor. And they'll wear that thing until Brother Mike comes around. And when I come around, I say, hey, what's that on your wrist there? And they'll, you know, hide it. You know. And the next time I come around, they'll have it around their waist under their clothes where I can't see it, or around their sock, you know, inside their sock where I can't see it. You know. So I'll stand up and I'll preach and I'll say, now, I know many of you, you're trying to overcome your traditions, but today you're wearing your good luck charm around your waist where I can't see it, you know. And they'll all start laughing, that nervous laugh, that, you know, because they have a terrible time. You know, I've been teaching, some of those people, I've been teaching the Bible 9 years, you know, and 6 years, and 4 years, and 5 years. And some of them, you know, probably the teenagers, they understand more what I'm talking about than anybody, because I've had them since they were kids, you know, and they're starting to come up now, and they're reaching early adulthood, and they'll actually argue with my older church members. You know, I heard one argument was going on where an older lady in church was going around saying, listen, you can obviously lose your salvation because Judas Iscariot lost it. And my own young guys in church were quizzing her, saying, Mrs. Simukonda, was Judas Iscariot saved? Was he a born-again person? And she was like, he was one of the disciples. You know, and those boys were able to handle that without me. So, I mean, it's not like we've never made any progress. I mean, I'm just telling you the things that hold our people back. You know, when lightning goes off there, when lightning goes off here, it may scare you a little bit, but when lightning goes off there, they ask the question, who? Who's after me? And so it's a great culture for people who already feel guilty about things. They're up to a lot of devilment, I'll tell you. Of course, I have informants, you know. I have so many informants that we have a witch doctor that's maybe about four streets over from our church, and everybody knows where he is. And I'll stand up and say, I know some of you think you are clever and you've been going to the witch doctor, and I want you to know people are telling me you're going there. And they'll all go, I'll say, relax, I'm just kidding. And they'll, oh, yeah. but some of them, I know they're going. They're still, some of my people are still going. Now, we've probably got 30 or 40 people that are very solid people. They're like the guy in verse 7. Sergius Paulus, a prudent man, who called for Barnabas and Saul and desired to hear the word of God. There are some of my people, I would say, out of 120, I would guess there are about 30, maybe a quarter of them, and they are truly hungry for the Word of God because they've tasted and they've seen the Lord is good and the Bible is right. Some of them have come to the point that they've said, yeah, there is truth and there is final authority, and what we believe, you know, Brother Samuel told me one day, I said, let's get this marriage thing pinned down, okay? Because from what I understand in your own culture, no one in our church is married in your culture even. They're just kind of, you know, couples, you know. Because, you know, in our culture, you know, we have a system that in our culture is a marriage. Over there, you know, they basically, forgive me, this is my view, to me, they're just buying a slave to me when they get married. Because, you know, you try to marriage counsel them and you say, hey, brother, why would you like to marry this woman? And he says, you know, I have a very big field now and I need to work her. And I'll just straight-faced say, okay, are there any other reasons? Are there any things you see in her character that you like? Yes, she is a very hard worker. She obeys her mother, and she does not beat people or insult people, and she is huge. I have to sit there and go, mm-hmm. You know, because you can't laugh at them like you're doing. You can't, you know, I mean, I know it's funny, you know, but I mean, it's hilarious. But I've seen them say, you know, I'm a single person and I'm cooking my own meals and washing my own clothes, and that's why I want to marry her. And I'll say, okay, that's good. You know, because I mean, you couldn't do that. You couldn't do that in America. That lady would reach over and slap you, and that'd be the end of it, wouldn't it? In America, you're supposed to say, I'm marrying her because I love her. And they don't have that type of relationship there. They just don't, you know. So I understand a lot of that. I try to adapt to some of that, and then I'll get up and preach and say, you men, you're rotten, you don't love your wife, you know. And they'll all look at me like, oh, brother, that was good. That was good preaching for a white man. That was good. You white men, you need to do that. I know. Like, especially things like flee youthful lust, you know, and I'll preach about promiscuity and fornication and stuff, and inevitably somebody going out the door will shake my hand and say, you white men, you need to do that. All right, brother, have a good day. You know? But it does get through eventually, because like I was telling the other people this morning, when you look at the video, there's some young people under a little shelter, and as it pans, there's a boy was sitting there with glasses. He's about 21 or 22. I've had him since he was 14. And he stood up on anniversary Sunday a year or two ago and stood up and said, thank God Brother Mike came here. Because of, you know, his influence, I've avoided almost all the vices of our society here that young people go through. And I sat there and thought, wow, I didn't know that, you know. Because a lot of days I stand up to preach and I just look out and I audibly say, oh, where were you guys last night? What am I preaching to? And they'll just kind of smile at me, you know. Because if I told you the statistics of why HIV was so big there, you would probably be angry with me for being so explicit. So I'm not going to tell you. But there is a reason. You know, the most conservative AIDS statistic you can find is like 18%, and some go up to 37, and it's really a lot worse than that. But a lot of those things are connected to witchcraft. For example, a man gets HIV. We say, well, he got infected through a blood transfusion or through fornication. And the African says, no, 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 no. Someone put a curse on him. Because here are two men. They're both very promiscuous. This one got HIV and this one didn't. So this one has very powerful magic and no one can curse him. And this man, he was cursed, so he got HIV. So they all shrug their shoulders like this and say, what can you do? You know? In animism, the guy who reaches the top is the guy with all the magic power, see? So no one wants to get to that place because everybody's gunning for him. So they're happy not to get to that place. They're happy to say, oh, I'm unemployed and I don't have anything and that's just the way life is. And that explains, you know, people look at the African and they say, why does the guy not have any drive to better himself or any, you know, any good ambition, not bad ambition. Well, all ambition's bad in a way, but how come the guy doesn't want to better himself? And the reason is if he starts going up, then people start saying, what can we do to knock him down? Because in their society, anybody that's going up, he has this magic power, this magic luck, and something must be done about him. But it also works in the reverse. Let me give you this example before I go too far away to explain my life to you day to day. I was reading a book by a guy. He's been in Congo 42 years, and this guy said he started the book with a four-year-old boy, an illustration that this boy had been terribly dehydrated and malnourished. So the parents took him to the missionary clinic. He was getting better for a week or two, and the father came, took him home. And the missionary said, listen, don't take this boy home. If you take him home and he doesn't stay in the clinic a couple more weeks, he'll probably die. The father disregarded it, took him home, and he died. And, you know, I've looked at that stuff for years and thought, now, why do these Africans do that? And I'm reading that book, and he said, what happened is that father went to the witch doctor. The witch doctor said, the grandmother cursed the boy, and he must die. So that man put his faith in that system, that tradition they have, and took the boy home to die. And there's no truth to it. The boy would have survived, you know. But the thing is, if you know about Calvinism, Calvinism is just something rooted in the carnal heart of man. You know? I don't know if you know that. But I've dealt with Africans and said, now listen, I'm going to have to discipline you about this. And, you know, you've done this thing. Is there anything you'd like to say? And he says, I guess it is the will of God. And I say, no, the will of God was for you not to commit that sin and to do the right thing and to grow as a Christian and not be disciplined. But you overthrew the will of God. You did the wrong thing. And the guy goes, nope, it was the will of God. There's nothing I can do. And you know, their whole system is rooted around this thing of, I can't do anything about it. I'm going to shrug my shoulders and say, it's you. You cursed me. You know, there's nothing I can do about it. And it's just a sad thing. And it's in church there, you know. So one of our people dies, and we have the funeral, and there's all these pagan superstitions. They'll pass a shovel around and have everybody touch the dirt in the shovel, and I'll ask four or five guys, hey, why do you touch the dirt in the shovel when you pass it around? And they'll go, I don't know. And I'll ask another guy, I don't know. Because they know I preach about all these things, you know. They know as soon as I find out on Sunday, I'm going to get up and preach how, you know, if you believe the Bible is the truth, it's nonsensical to do these things you're doing. And it's a sad and tragic thing to look at a culture that has no foundation of Christianity. And I thought when I was going over there that I'm going to be dealing with people very similar to the people you deal with here in America. They're going to think very similarly, but they're hungry for the gospel. And I got there and found out, that's not what's going on. What's going on is they believe in luck. They believe I have good luck because I'm an American. And every American is what? Dripping with money. You know, you sneeze, $10 bills. You know? That's what they believe. You know, they believe, you know, I've pulled up to a police checkpoint and the policeman says, excuse me. And I'll say, yes. He said, are you an American? Yes. Can you get me a tracksuit when you go to America? I said, well, you know, I don't know. Maybe I could. And how about $1,000 for an air ticket? And I'm like, $1,000? He said, it's nothing to you. I thought, oh, brother. I said, listen, 1,000 kwacha, you know, 20 cents. 1,000 kwacha is not $1,000. He says, it's nothing to you Americans, you know. But, you know, they think we're so prosperous that if they'll get close to us, the luck will rub off, you know. And so they'll come around. And I'm telling you, I know how to have a church of 1,000 people there. I do. I know the system of how to do it, but I will not do it. You know, I know how to, you know, there are missionaries there that give handouts. They get a big number of people. And then it gets to where they just can't keep giving the handouts and they lose 2/3 of their church overnight, you know. And the fact of the matter is, you know, the people will come close to you looking for luck. And when something goes wrong in their life, they'll say, something's gone wrong in my life. It must be my church. And they'll flip over and change churches. It happens all the time. And I'll go to that guy and say, listen, brother, you're going to charismatic church now. Don't you think their doctrine's wrong? Oh, yeah. Do you think they're even, you know, exactly right on salvation, eternal security? Do you think they're right? Oh, no, they're not right. Why are you going to their church? And everybody in the room just looks at each other. Because they don't want to say to me, you know, I was looking for a change in my luck. You know, because they know I've preached about that and taught about it so long that it's just not the right thing to do. But come over to Acts 14, and I'll show you another thing we try to do. Try. In Acts 14:23, when they come back from the second missionary journey, it says, and when they had ordained them elders in every church and had prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord on whom they believed. And the next thing I'm going to say is, you know, we have a weeding out process there, because every week men come to me and say, I've been called to preach. I want you to train me as a pastor. And I know missionaries with, you know, Bible schools of more than 100 students, because every man that comes to them and says, train me as a pastor, he says, wow, here's a God-called man. I'm going to train him as a pastor. And he doesn't know, when the man graduates Bible school, he says, okay, missionary, where's my salary? I graduated Bible school. You're going to pay me now, right? And so some of those missionaries start thinking, wow, what do I do? Well, I'll go back to America, I'll show pictures of these guys, and I'll raise $50 a month for them, you know, from different churches. And I've looked at that system and thought, that's not the way to do things. Number one, almost all those missionaries find out later the pastors that they're training are drunkards, you know, and you know, they've got all these different women and stuff. And I've watched all that and thought, there's got to be a weeding out process. And the guys that come to me, the first thing I say is, okay, God's called you to preach. Explain to me how to be saved. And 9 out of 10 of them do not know how to be saved. They just know that there's a missionary here. It's 80% unemployment. And maybe at the end of Bible college, he'll get me a job. After all, you know, you go to technical school, and at the end of technical school, you get a job in that field, right? So they think, I go to Bible college, that missionary is going to employ me as a pastor somewhere. And there are so many mission groups that do it that it's a normal thing to think. And I have to tell guys, listen, I don't do that. I just tell them up front, I don't train pastors. That's not what I do. And they look at me like, what kind of missionary are you? And I'll say, listen, what you can do, number one, if you're saved. You know, if they're not saved, we have that discussion and they go on their way. But I say, if you're saved, we just have a church. You can join it. You can look at our doctrine. If you agree with it, you can join. If you don't agree with it, you can't join. And if you join, we'll watch you for 6 months, and then we'll put one guy with you to teach you the Bible one-on-one for 1 year. If you stay with that, then we'll put you in Bible school. Maybe. And if we put you in Bible school, you can go to Bible school for 3 years, and I promise you, when you get out, you will not get a salary. And they go, And I explain to them why. I explain to them, listen, one day I'm going to get sick or die, or immigration's going to kick me out or something, and I plan for those churches to support themselves and carry on, and I even expect them not only to support themselves but to send out their own missionaries and support them. And that first church we started does that. You know, they support their own pastor, and they support that second mission work we have, the work that's in the school. They pay all their rent and all their bills for that second church. And that's one African church. And when I went there, people told me, you cannot have a self-supporting African church. And I said, you can if you give handouts to people. You can't. As long as you give the African the handout, he'll say, okay, keep it coming. Keep it coming. I was watching one day a Seventh-day Adventist program on Zambian TV, and it said they were providing seeds for all these peasant farmers. And they explained the system was, you provide the seeds, and then the farmer gets to the place where he's on his own and he no longer needs support, he just supports himself. And they had in mind a self-supporting program, but every African they interviewed said things like this, well done SDA, keep it up, keep giving us. And I thought, those guys don't get that. As long as you start out by giving them the handout, they think it's always going to keep coming. And what you've got to do is, you've got, early on in that church, I told them, I said, listen, I'm not paying the bills. You're going to have to pay the bills. Nobody sent me here to give out handouts and pay the bills. I had one missionary friend, he schooled me well. He said I had a church that it was basically funeral insurance for everyone, because funerals run about around $50 maybe. And so any church member he had that had, you know, a funeral in their, even their, not their immediate family, but somewhere in their close extended family, he'd pay all the transport, all the food, the coffin, everything, $50, $60 every funeral. And so one day he stood up and said, listen, he said, I can't afford that anymore. The deacons have met, and what they're going to do is they're going to give out of the church offerings a certain amount for every funeral, which amounted to about $1.50 a funeral. He said people were walking out as he spoke, and the next week he had one-third of his church. The other two-thirds were coming for funeral insurance. And see, I could have a big church. All you got to do is pay for everybody's funeral expense. I could have a lot bigger church. But we don't do things that way. And, you know, there's no way. I know the way it is, being an American. You look at those people and you say, oh, they're poor. Oh, I just, you know, I want to adopt an orphan, and I want to help them, and I want to give them money. And it's not the solution. Their economic system in those townships and villages is not based on cash. It's based on maize. And so, you know, people come over there and give them cash, and they say, woo, beer money. We didn't have beer money before. And that's what they do. You know, I've had missionaries. I've said, hey, brother, you're evangelist. I met him in town the other day, and he was, you know, walking like this. You know. And the missionary says, well, I can't believe you'd say that about my evangelist. And I think, oh, okay. You know, he doesn't want to believe it. You know, he's never met the evangelist when he's drunk like that. But he's paying that guy $50 a month, you know, and he's believing in that guy. And I learned early on in 98 and 99, I worked with three other missionaries. And I sat back and I watched the system, and I decided, you don't give handouts. A lady came to me. I didn't know she was a wealthy lady. I didn't know who she was. I'd been in the country about 2 or 3 weeks. And she came to me and she said, Mike Dobbins, I need fertilizer for my field, and you are my only hope. And she said that, and I thought, my goodness, that's a terrible thing for my ears to hear from a, a Christian woman. You're my only hope. So I said, ma'am, I'm sorry. I said, I can't agree with that. And I said, there's no way I could help you buy fertilizer if in your heart your faith is in me and I'm your only hope. So I would never do that. I'm sorry. I said, you know, I'll pray with you about it. And I sent her on her way. She met me at church 2 or 3 days later, and she said, praise God you didn't give me that money. The Lord provided it another way. And I didn't know she was a rich lady. She walked away, and another African walked up and said, do you know who that is? And I said, no, I know it's Mrs. Chimfumpa. And she said her husband was the head of all the prisons in Zambia, big government job. And he said, she is a very wealthy woman. She doesn't need fertilizer money. She said, she already had that money when she asked you. But, you know, why spend your own money when you can go ask the missionary for it? Amen? I mean, you know, if there was a guy that, you know, just gave out money, wouldn't you go and get some money off of him? I would, you know, and that's the system, you know. And you know, I watched that for a year and a half when I worked with those other missionaries, and I decided that's not what we're going to do. And when we moved to Chingola, we started off with, listen, if poor people need help in this church, you African people are going to help the poor people. That's what we're going to do. And they were like, but we're poor ourselves. But that, you know, it's relative, isn't it? They're poor. But, you know, there's some men in my church that make money. There are a couple of men in my church that make good money. And, you know, we have a certain amount set aside for our poor people that have genuine needs. And when other poor people come to me, I say, listen, we help the poor people in our church. Where do you go to church? And they say, you. And I say, listen, if all the churches help their own poor people, it'd work out. So that's the system we're using. Amen? And they always say, what kind of missionary are you? And I say, I am the Bible-believing kind. And they say things like, do you mean the other missionaries don't believe the Bible? And I say, yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. And they say, oh, you. And I say, have a good day. You know, they think I'm as bizarre as some of you do, I'm sure. But, but you know, I really believe early on, you know, because when I got there, I said this. I said, God, I don't understand these people. You know, I don't even know how to witness to people here. And I need you to give me some wisdom and open my eyes and help me to understand how to deal with these people. And, you know, I've gotten around the table with other missionaries who don't have this elaborate weeding out system, who don't know, who've never learned that language and don't know anything about animism. And they're some of the most frustrated people you would ever meet. You know, they're pulling their hair out and crying, why is it all my pastors are committing adultery? And it may happen to me. You know, I've never had it yet, but it may happen to me. I may go back to Zambia and start hearing the rumors that one or two or all of my pastors have done the same thing. But at least I had a system where the man off the street couldn't just walk up and be put into a position when, you know, the truth is an African will hang around you for years just to see if you'll buy him something, you know. Yeah, one guy told me, an evangelical who's been there for years, he said, don't forget, brother, an African will work with you for 20 years to see if you'll buy him a fridge or refrigerator. And I thought, what? I said, I thought my weeding out system, you know, I mean, because it takes the guy several years down the road, he has to really hang in there. He said, oh, that's nothing. He said, they'll hang in there longer than that. I said, you're kidding me. And he said, nope. Because, you know, there's nothing to lose. You know, there's nothing to lose. There's nothing else there. And it's just, it's a sad, brutal thing. But, you know, I've had Africans come to me and say, you see, my foot is swollen. And I'll say, yeah. And he'll say, cast the spirit out of it. And I'll say, have you done anything unusual the last few days? And they'll say, well, yeah, there was one day I walked out to my field and back from 6 a.m. To 6 at night, 12 hours. And I'll say, do you think your foot swole up because you walked 12 hours that day? And he said, nope. It's a spirit. Are you going to cast it out or should I go ask the other missionary? I said, go ask the other missionary. I'm not going to do it. But the thing it comes down to is it comes down to this book right here. And you know what I've learned? It doesn't matter if it's an American college student or an evolutionist or an atheist or an African in the bush. People do not believe or love this book, generally. And we have a few saved people who are getting a grip on it. And, you know, I didn't realize when I went there that I was just going to be picking out a few handfuls of purpose. I thought I was going to go over and have this big harvest, and that's what I was looking forward to. And I wouldn't say that I've been gutted and disappointed that, you know, I've not had that. I guess in a way anybody would be. I did have some great expectations, but now, you know, I realize, you know, everywhere the gospel is preached, some people receive it and some people don't. And when you see these guys that go to the mission field and they have 1,000 people and they're preaching to them and saying, repeat this prayer, and all 1,000 people raise their hand that they got saved, there's nothing like that in the Bible. In the Bible, there's always some believe and some believe not. Wherever there's a great Scofield note on it where Scofield says, everywhere the gospel is preached, it is received by some and rejected by some. And if you go into that school, if you yourself go in there and preach to that 1,000 people, they will all pray with you and raise their hand on Monday, if you go Monday. If you go back Tuesday, the same group will all pray and raise their hand on Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, because it's just better luck the more you do it. They don't understand what in the world you're talking about unless you sit with them one-on-one and say, listen, let's talk about these things. Who goes to hell? Because an African believes your spirit goes out of your body. That he doesn't know what a soul is. You know, he doesn't know about body, soul, and spirit. He believes, I've got a body that goes to the ground and my spirit just wanders the earth looking for a resting place. I've caught Baptist preachers there preaching it. I've had my own members come back and say, hey, do you know Peter Nkumbwa? And I say, yeah. Well, I was at his church the other day and he preached, when your spirit leaves your body, it wanders the earth looking for a resting place. Which is just traditional African superstition. And you know, me and my church member just laugh and say, I didn't know he preached that. You know, he was trained at the Bible college. The very Bible college that I set up their structure for all their curriculum and classes out in the bush years ago. And that's what he preaches. And it's just superstition. You know, I know ladies that, not in my church, but other Christian ladies, you know, they'll have a friend that dies, maybe their baby passed away, and they'll go over to see the lady and they'll stand in the room this far from her and say, hello, how are you? Hello. And she won't go over, she won't touch her. Because if you touch her, then the spirit of that baby may, you know, jump on her and cause her a problem, you know. And so, you know, I'm sorry I've wandered around aimlessly. Can you tell I'm tired? It feels like the heat's on in here. but if you do pray for us, you know, get a prayer card. And if you do pray for us, try to remember to pray about these things. Pray that God will send us some faithful men. Because, you know, if we have some faithful men that will, you know, begin to get grounded in the Bible, that's the only hope for those people, is to have a few men here and there. Because, you know, for about the first 5 years I was there, I was one man all alone. And people were looking at me like, this is the only person in the world who believes that. And, you know, I had Brother Flick come over and he preached, and they thought, there's two of them. You know, and I had Brother Donovan come, and they thought, Brother Donovan preached on what is the worst thing an African thinks Christ ever said, where he said, follow me and let the dead bury their dead. That for Africans, they'll look at that and say, that's wrong. That is, they'll even say that is witchcraft, to have no respect for the dead. Because to them, death is everything. And they, you know, they'll take that dead body and whisper in his ear and say, your uncle's here. You know, at the funeral, they'll say, your uncle's here, and right now they're loading you in the vehicle to take you to the mortuary, you know, to the dead body, you know. And I'll get up and preach and say, what are you guys doing? You know, I mean, I know one Bible verse the Jehovah's Witness knows. It says, the dead know not anything. That dead guy doesn't know what you're saying to him, but they believe, you know, something's still connected there. I mean, you don't want to disrespect him. You don't want to disrespect that dead body, you know. Because I'll tell them, you know, I had a relative, you know, and my relative was lost. He died and went to hell. And you can see him all stiffen, like, ooh, he just accused his ancestor of going to hell, you know. And there's just, you know, you might look at it and say, boy, it's just hopeless. But it's not hopeless. They need somebody to, you know, sit with them and explain, you know, this is the truth. What you believe is just fairy tales. You know, no Africans believe in evolution. That's a fairy tale for Americans and educated people and Europeans. In Africa, what I've explained to you today is what they believe. You can't fathom it. There's nothing in your mind. There's nothing. You don't wake up in the morning and put your shirt on and say, oh, I wonder if there's a bad spirit connected to my shirt, you know? But that's what an African goes through. He lives in constant fear of that stuff. And I'll show him a verse like, the Lord has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. And they'll say, And I'll preach on the fear of man bringeth a snare. And I'll preach on the, you know, fearing the witch doctor and fearing everything except sin, you know? And if you heard me preach over there, you would be amazed, because I have to preach a completely different way than you preach to Americans. But of course, a lot of the things are exactly the same, aren't they? The doctrine is the same. But the practical things day to day would blow your mind. So if you guys pray for us, keep these things in mind, and you'll know some of the opposition we're up against if you can recall these things. Brother Hoffman, are you going to come? All right. Brother Donovan preached a message on first, second, third generation Christian, something like that. And so we probably had 200 or 250 people that night. We had a lot of people in there that night. And he said, how many of you are the first person saved in your family? You're a first generation Christian. And three guys stood up. And I thought, almost all these guys. And then I began to realize, So we got in the pickup. You know, I didn't want to tell Brother Donovan what was going on, you know, because, you know, a lot of these things, you know, you don't want to shock people. So Brother Flick's in the pickup with us, and he knows what's going on. He says, hey, Brother Mike, why do you think only three people stood up on first-generation Christians? And I said, well, they don't want to publicly stand up and say, none of my ancestors were saved. They're in hell. Because, you know, they believe their ancestors are watching them. You know, they believe they're present. You know, you and I believe the people we can see are the people that are here. They believe the people we can see are here and a few others that you can't see are here watching. And Brother Don is sitting there and he goes, because, you know, with that in mind, that kind of messed the message up. You know, once you know that truth, that this guy's afraid to say, hey, my ancestors were lost, or hey, my ancestors, you know, were this way or that way. To say that publicly, you can bring a bad curse on yourself if you're, you know, just like I said something bad about one of my relatives that passed away, and they were like, yeah, don't do that. You know, or I'll say, now my father, he wasn't a good Christian growing up, and you can see him going, and I'm like, I'm not worried about that. That's, you know, I don't believe, you know, my dad in America 8,000 miles away can kind of somehow spookily, you know, I just don't believe that. But anyway, I can tell these stories 6 hours. Come.